We tend to use language in two different ways. We use language quite literally for efficient communication, and then we use it symbolically because it evokes something much deeper, much more imaginative. And to my mind, there's nothing more humorous than seeing children try to embrace symbolic or imaginative language. When we're children, we tend to mock anything that is metaphoric. I can remember once as kids getting really smart with our dad, it was a back and forth, and he looked at us and he said, "I can see you're as wise as owls." And we said back to him, "Have you even met an owl?" I remember our mother once saying, when someone was praising us, a neighbor, she said, "Oh, they're my treasure." And we said, "Do you think she's going to put us in her safety deposit box?" I remember once producing something that my father didn't expect. And he said, "Why, Timmy, you are just a cornucopia of surprises." To which my brother said, "Maybe we can pack him away until Halloween." You see how much we embrace symbolic language when we're young. But symbolic language is part and parcel of our faith. How many times in Scripture does language have to be symbolic in order for us to have a deeper understanding of God? In Deuteronomy, we hear symbolically that God is a rock. We all know the 23rd Psalm, where God is likened to a shepherd. The prophet Isaiah uses the image of God as the potter and we are the clay. And even the book of Revelation says God is Alpha and Omega, the two characters of the Greek alphabet, the beginning and the end. And in the Gospels, there is no text more symbolic or revelatory than John's Gospel. In chapter 6, John says that Jesus is the bread of life. In chapter 8, we hear that Jesus is the light of the world. In chapter 15, we hear that Jesus is the vine and we are the branches. But today, in this third Sunday of Lent, we have an image of God, an image of Jesus, which we normally take for granted. Jesus as water, but not just any kind of water, living water. Why this image? And why this particular exchange between the Samaritan woman at the well and Jesus? Because this is such a symbolic gospel, I tend to turn to a few scholars of the word for help in understanding it, because you can't just take it literally at first glance. And the three scholars I look at are the late Monica Helwig, formerly of Georgetown University, Sister Sandra Schneiders, an IHM sister, a professor emeritus at the Jesuit School of Theology in Berkeley, and Father Jerome Neri, formerly of the University of Notre Dame, because they help us understand the history, the context, and the dynamic of the reading. Now, Monica Helwig and Sister Sandra Schneiders both tell us that always in this biblical literature, there's a spousal relationship between God and Israel. And so the woman comes to symbolize more than just a woman at the well, but this spousal connection. And for those of us who know the deeper backstory of this gospel, before Jesus sees her at the well, he asks where her husband is, and then he calls her out and says, "Well, you not only have one, you've had five husbands," which seems to impugn her. But that's why the symbolism is so important, because the woman helps us to see the historic relationship between God and the chosen people. The chosen people continually reject God. Sometimes they turn to idols. Sometimes they turn to multiple gods. Sometimes they abandon God. And what God tries to say in Jesus is that no matter how often we reject God, God will always find us. But then to go deeper, recognizing the rift between the people of Israel and the people of Samaria, it's very interesting that a foreigner, so to speak, someone from outside the chosen people, would be the one to interact with Jesus. And what's unique about the Samaritan woman is she comes to the well at noon. Women went and got water in the morning or late at night. They didn't go out in the hot sun, certainly not when the commerce of the day was happening.
So what does it teach us? It teaches us how God can break through our limited world and how God can find us where we are most needed. What is the one thing the Samaritan woman says that we should hear on this third Sunday? She says, "I thirst." A basic human common need. And what does Jesus answer her with? He says, "This well will only feed you for a day. I will give you water that will feed you forever." Think about it. Something that would feed us forever. I swear to God, if we found a cell phone that never needed to be recharged, we would wrap a line around either the Apple store or our Droid store. We'd wait 24, 48, 72 hours for a cell phone that never charged. How often would we wait for anything that didn't need to be recharged? Imagine a drink of water that would quench your thirst forever. This is quite valuable. Now you see why I began with the naivete of children in symbolic language. Jesus is not trying to close the water market. What is living water symbolic of? Well, what do we thirst for? Think of the most arid, the most dry, the most abandoned parts of our lives. Often what we most thirst for is faith. When life is just too hard, when we just can't take it, we thirst for God. And not unlike the Samaritan woman, we get tired of going to the well day after day, week after week. When will my thirst be quenched? But Jesus reminds us that sometimes it's when we least expect it that our thirst is quenched. I remember once going to a hospice. A guy had leukemia, and he was writing memoirs. And I asked him what he was writing. He says, "I don't know if they'll publish this when I'm alive or when I'm dead, but I'm writing a book titled Laughing with Leukemia." And I said, "Well, I appreciate the onomatopoeia of laughing with leukemia, but that's not how most people view blood cancer." And he said, "Oh, if you know what happens to me day after day, at some point you just give up fighting and you start to laugh. And I can't tell you how funny this disease can be." Someone who has found, perhaps, life-giving water. I know someone who experienced an enormous reversal of fortune. His business fell on hard times and he couldn't find a way to reinvent himself. And so he had to readjust his lifestyle, readjust everything. And he said to me, "You know, at first I thought I was a colossal failure. I wondered why I should live anymore. But I began to discover that hope wasn't in making more or getting ahead. Hope was in the very people who gave me life, gave me joy, and gave me hope." And in there, he found living water. And I even knew a woman who talked about the fighting that was happening in her home and amongst her families. First it was over an estate, then it was over who lived where and who wasn't caring for the other dying parent. And all of a sudden that found in all that screaming and all that shouting, they were communicating again and said, "Oh my God, it took this to bring us head to head, and now we are with one another." Finding life-giving water. We all thirst. We all beg for that which will fill us, which will sate us, which will propel us forward. Do we have the courage of the Samaritan woman to turn to Jesus in the face outside of our comfort zone and beg, "I thirst," because only then will our thirst be quenched. At this Mass, our 12 elect have come here in part because they thirst. Layla, Paula, Dustin, Sean, Quincy, Catherine, Stephen, Jacob, Allison, Keith, Adam, and Jin, come to our faith. Come to this church. Come to Jesus for that water which will quench every thirst. Do we have the same courage, the same faith, the same resolve, like the Samaritan woman, to ask for the same?